So welcome to this week's edition of the Retail Risk Podcast, sponsored by Centomatic, and thanks also to our supporting partner, Orage. Now, my guest this week is Erik Enstrand. Erik, I met at an event, a Retail Risk event in Scandinavia a good few years back. I can't recall if it was Oslo or Stockholm, but I still remember being... Oslo, was it? I still remember being traumatized at the cost of a round of drinks at the bar. He's got a fantastic depth of knowledge, huge range of expertise. Today he's the CEO of the Safe Asset Group, but prior to that, he has one of the most interesting CVs, resumes that you want to come across. So, Erik, thank you so much indeed for finding the time to join us this week.
Oh, thank you, Paul. Looking forward just to talking and sharing experience and see where this goes in our good conversation. So really great.
Yeah, now the first place I want to start with you, and I'll come back to what you're doing at the moment, but you've got such a broad range of experiences. And it all started off, or maybe something before this, but at Lindex, well-known Swedish retailer. Am I right? Something like 700 stores, 12, 15, 18 countries, offices in Asia. Was it 2005, 2006?
Yeah.
You started there. What did the world of risk management and loss prevention look like for a Swedish retailer in 2006?
Yeah, no, I would say that was a challenge. And you're correct. Lindex is one of the largest retailers in Scandinavia. And they are downsized a bit now. But back then, wow, we're really getting old. But it was quite basic. We just started with the data mining and exploring how to use data and tills and so on to find information where we should search and so. But for me, the biggest challenge in stepping into to Lindex was actually, it was 97% women working in the organization. And I had a bit of a working in security and military industry. So my biggest challenge was actually the language. So to be politically correct in speaking and just putting requirements on the organization. So that was the biggest challenge for me, just to adopt kind of a security thinking into a retail woman-centric kind of organization to really get things going. So that was the biggest challenge for me stepping in.
Well, and in terms of the risks at the time, I mean, you know, now you've got sort of, you know, the digital issues, cyber, organized retail crime. What occupied your days at the time? What were the threats and the risks and how did you sort of tackle them? Because I think you were there, was it 6 years, 7 years?
Yeah, correct. No, I would say the focus really was store focused on traditional loss prevention from a customer, theft, organized retail crime. We also did a lot of expansion into Poland, Slovakia, Czech Republic and Russia. And that was also the challenge. And the other challenge was our production offices in Asia. So my job was partly also then to look at loss prevention from a logistic perspective and try to get the overall framework for Lindex, because they had been working isolated with stores, with logistics, with production offices, but now they wanted a framework because everything had an effect. So I would say going from traditional loss prevention into more corporate view of loss prevention and connecting this to insurance and more modern kind of risk management thinking, that was my challenge to move away from security and focus more on a holistic view of loss prevention and risk management for Lindex as an organization. And as with everything, starts with management. So my job was basically to formulate this and then to start selling it to the different stakeholders. And I remember my boss, he took me into the office and he says, "Erik, you need to really have a look at this." And he showed me a big cupboard with all the statistics and Arthur Andersen and McKinsey and KPMG reports on loss prevention. He goes, "I don't want anything of this. I want you to be like Nike. Just do it. Go out and do it. You don't need to produce paper. So we want hands-on experience getting this going across the organization. So they were more focused on results than producing paper frameworks also. So that was also a challenge to me, but super interesting, challenging, and a lot of things that I had actually, to be honest, no clue about, that I had to realize and set the whole, my own framework. And that's really where different types of networks and people and security networks come in, where you can reach out and get help and get support and really start to move that challenge forward.
So a question for you, I'm not sure I know the answer to this. So you were brought in, and it sounds like, if you like, the senior management and the board had decided they didn't want another McKinsey-esque report, but in the nicest sense, why did they turn to you for that role? What had you been doing previously that made them think, oh, actually, Eric's the man that we want?
Yeah, no, that was a surprise to me as well. No, they wanted somebody with a quite good international experience to understand different cultures. And I've traveled quite extensively previous work and implemented risk and security. So they wanted somebody to really understand the culture aspects in Asia and in different other territories, because culture is the strong, adversary to implementing a good security framework. So you can have all the papers in the world, but if you don't understand how cultures are working, and in Asia, everybody said yes to everything, but nothing happened, and it was totally different in the way they acted than what they said. So to me, the strong decision-making point was the international experience and understanding of cultures and risk management. That was the driver from the board, because they were heading out on a journey in starting to expand large and quick outside of Sweden into Saudi Arabia, into the Baltic states they've done before, Russia. So quite complex markets where the culture and the attitude of people, organized crime, totally different than in Scandinavia. And you needed somebody understanding that people are people, and how do they act in different types of environments. Like in Russia, we call it sticky hands, because somebody touched something, it just stuck to their hand and it never left the hand. So that was a challenge. You know, how do you work with that in a correct way?
Yeah, interesting. And would you say that, you say the sort of use the sticky hands analogy, in different parts of the world, things that we might find unacceptable are just the norm. And to your point about certain cultures just can't say no to anything, so everything's a yes, and then, as you say, doesn't happen. Other cultures, it might be considered perfectly acceptable to top up your salary by helping yourself to some stock. Is that your experience from when you were growing into other markets?
Absolutely. I mean, you have different views of acting and loyalty against the company, and in certain markets you have the first loyalty yourself. So that means, I can give another example. In Bangladesh, you had the corporate drivers. Well, of course, they had company cars, but they changed the tires. They filled up the gasoline. They faked out mileage reports and used the car for private consumption. They changed the new parts of the engine to old parts and sold them, because they thought it was the correct way to do, and they wanted to top off their salary because the payment was maybe different and they had longer hours. So it was also to change the corporate culture from our management, to understand that they had to maybe pay people a bit more to build away these obstacles. But again, it's hard to change, and culture really needs a strong focus to minimize losses across a corporate environment.
Yeah, fascinating. Again, so often you see corporates sort of this one size fits all, and then they can't understand when they've gone into a market why they have to pull out with huge losses 10 years later. So I think you've called it absolutely correctly. Now, So you did your time at Lindex and you thought, do you know what? That was a little bit challenging. And obviously at that point, I believe you decided it might be time to maybe take it easy. And so is that when you went to IKEA? Now, I love this. Russia and CIS states, risk and insurance manager.
Yeah.
Were you the only person that would take that role? Were you the last man standing in the application process?
Well, again, the challenge stepping into Lindex was really the complex environments and understanding them, like Bangladesh and India, Turkey, China, and cultures. And with Lindex, we expanded into Russia. We opened up stores in Russia. And one of the first experiences in Lindex for opening stores was that it was a huge shopping center. We spent a lot of efforts, project money, to open up a flag store in St. Petersburg on this asset. And on the opening day, when I did my opening week, I did my checks. I opened all the fire cabinets, I checked the hydrants and everything on the asset. Nothing was there. It was empty. But we had a certificate from the fire authorities giving us an approval to open up. But the fire safety of the whole asset, it was non-existing. But according to our paperwork, everything was there. So this I highlighted all the risk to our CEO. I said, we can't open the store. We have to wait until all of this is in place. And he says, no, we have to open up. It's a grand opening. The mayor is here and everything. So what do we do? So we have to kind of create our own emergency response and own security for evacuation and so on. And then I had to look into this. But this really put the context out of the complexity into Russia. So now I got asked by IKEA to step into the role of risk manager and insurance on the Russian market. I said, that's a challenge. You know, they have a different type of culture, a different way of looking at corruption. You have to navigate this in quite a complex way. So I thought that's a challenge. That's what I want to do. So that was kind of the driver in accepting the role and putting my family and myself into Russia, which is a fantastic country to live in and enjoyable, great people. But it had some cultural challenges and corruption challenges for sure.
And in terms of, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I have a vague recollection of, am I right in thinking that, does IKEA have its own woodlands? Is that right?
Yeah, they have own production, woods in Siberia, they own.
The security of that as well?
Yes.
So how does that work?
Well, you do satellite imaging of forestry and you check where they are cutting down woods, and you have a lot of black lodging. That is the huge opportunity for people with a different mindset of looking at business. So it was really to set out the forestry and to see the weak development of where it's being cut down, and then to check against our kind of inventory of production and where we have ordered, to see where are they actually cutting down woods. And then we found woods and large parts where we actually didn't do any production, but it was still missing. So then we had to go into investigation to see who is doing that and why. And the why was quite clear, of course. But it was a challenge just to find the correct imagery also, the service providers, just to see how do we actually lose out on wood production, because it's quite expensive and it's quite high value in the black lodging market. So that was a totally new challenge. But again, just identifying the risk, finding the right providers and just understanding what are the losses and the drivers in this, and then set up a strategy. So that was one of the aspects of loss prevention in Russia. The other challenge was at this time, security guard companies, because they sometimes worked in quite close collusion with the stores. And they were teaching kind of store managers how to steal out of the stores and worked in collusion with them during nighttime or during daytime, that they supported the local organized crime. So an integrated approach to community security, where you had store manager, you had organized crime, and you had the local security or in collusion. So nobody's telling anything. And how do you find this out? What are the indicators of this loss? And of course, that's when the store is starting to complain to management that after their stock inventory. So then you have to have a good communication with your tenants and to understand, and then to identify and to understand that some of the security guard companies in that market you cannot trust. So you then have to have different, maybe CCTV operators that is actually monitoring the security guard companies. You have to have layer of layer of checks and controls and gain information and intelligence to really identify these super complex environments of preventing losses.
Yeah, it reminds me, I mean, two things spring to mind. Firstly, I've got visions of an IKEA branded satellite somewhere around just checking on the Woodlands,
and there's no such
there's Eric dialing into it just to check. So if you think of doing a theft and sort of driving off, beware, that satellite might follow you. But it does remind me, many years ago I did a piece of work with a well-known UK retailer who were looking to expand, and this was a Moscow store and beyond. And I remember we had to have somebody with us locally, and hopefully I'm not going to get myself in trouble or anybody else, but there were so many people at steps along the way that wanted thanking for their part in facilitating the store to open, that that management of the large retailer, who I shan't name, brought in somebody and basically who knew who to pay off and who not to pay off. And it wasn't a payoff. It was consultancy to make that bit of the problem go smoothly. But it was just incredibly eye-opening. And it went all the way through to, I remember checking in at my hotel, and the front desk at the hotel knew that I was there to work on a project. And I'd been told, you know, not just get in a car that somebody's holding your name up. This is the registration number. This is a picture of the car. And in those days, it was sort of faxed to you before you get on the flight. Yeah. 2 hours to clear customs. And it was just, it was fascinating experience. But yeah, but it was just the way that business was done.
It's correct. It's a very complex market to navigate through and to keep on the right track. And I would say, you know, you have the local fire authorities. They are having their local rules, and they might want an extra fire truck because they don't have the capacity to service the large store or the facility. So, you know, and it's very complex. And also, if you do an investigation, you can never give a notice in advance that you're traveling, not even to your maybe personal assistant, because they might give that information to the store manager, center manager, or to the hotel, and they will give that information just kind of protect the local people and so on. So it's a challenge. It has changed. And I have to say, I saw a lot of positive developments in Russia right now. I don't know. It's becoming more complex with COVID and the finance and political situation. But I still think from a loss prevention, you do have to understand the culture complexity of that society to be able to minimize losses across a whole chain of logistics, stores, people, recruiting, it's. But that's the challenge. That's the drive. That's the fun. I mean, that's what drives probably you and me in taking this on.
And I'm not right in thinking. So you had Russia and the CIS states, and actually we had a I don't know who was in it at the time, but we had a quiz over breakfast this morning in the Besant household. My boys are 8 and 9, love geography, but we struggled collectively to name the CIS countries. But obviously, it's the former parts of Russia, if you like. And I think we came up with Belarus, Georgia, and Kazakhstan was in there. But did IKEA have a footprint in that broad, was it Russia and into those former yes. parts of Russia? So you had a huge territory.
Yeah, no, but in there, they don't have stores, but they have production offices, purchasing of maybe local goods. You might have in some countries somebody that's really good at a certain technique of woodwork, and then you import it from there. So you have the whole complexity, and you have different units of the kind of IKEA organization, purchasing and so on, that is represented in those countries. There might be production of local things that is just sold to the Russian market, and so on. So yes, that's the whole of those former USSR states that are the CIS states, and Kazakhstan and Ukraine. And right now they actually opened up stores in Ukraine just a couple of months ago, but the land plots were purchased in 2005. But again, the complexity of understanding the ownership of land plots in these markets is a huge opportunity for losses. So you have to be really careful when buying or selling land or housing, because it might be professional legal setup that is actually the objective is to let you buy it, pay for it, and then come back and sue you to actually show that you've done a falsified transaction according to Russian law, and then they want to come to an agreement with you. So you have the complexity in different levels. So store loss and theft, that's the easy part, but the complexity with lawyers driving this issue is a huge challenge.
I remember when I arrived on the particular project, there was a plot of land which had been or thought to have been bought. And it was actually going to be a staging point for a distribution opposed to the actual store. And when somebody had gone there to have a look at it to start drawing up plans, there was a hotel under construction on the site. And
oops.
I wasn't involved in the specifics. I don't know how that was resolved, but I remember being privy to the conversation about, you know, some construction already underway.
Well, that's what I call the oops factor in risk management, that oops, we didn't think about that, we didn't see it coming, so then how do you act?
I think that was actually the driver for a sort of local, I think the job title was country manager, but sort of facilitator to navigate all of the quirks.
Well, that is needed, you know, because stepping into such an environment without previous exposure, that is a huge risk in itself. Sometimes it could be an opportunity because you don't understand it, so you just move ahead really fast, and then you have to later take care of these problems. So, a local country manager is always needed. And we have that in our organization all over. Otherwise, it's impossible to act.
So, yeah, absolutely. So we started off in Sweden, Scandinavia. Yeah. You've been gradually moving across the globe. China came next, did it not?
Yeah.
Was that, had your time at IKEA come to an end, the opportunity presented it in China? What? Because there was definitely a window, and I think you were in that window looking at timelines, where a lot of the big brands and Western retailers wanted to get into the Chinese market. Is that when you used your expertise to provide some advice?
Yeah, well, the reason was quite simple. It was an old acquaintance that has been operating kind of boutique risk and security consultancy firm in China called PSU. And they've been on the Chinese market for 14 years. So we always had a dialogue about coming over and working. So I had a three-year contract as a kind of expat with the IKEA in Russia. So that was coming to its end. And at that time, I reached out. And then the culture complexity in Russia fitted quite well into a different kind of complex environment like China. And so I thought this was a opportunity to learn more and also then to reach out to some of the former retail colleagues I had that were also had their business up and running with purchasing offices and setting up stores. So it was quite natural to move into that environment with PSU. So I was based in Beijing and working out of Shanghai, also working down in Beihai on the southern part, close to Vietnam, with helping Scandinavian companies navigating the risks that you have from a local culture context. I mean, we had people doing sit-down strikes at factories, at offices with old women, because you can't really touch them. And they just sit there and stop the production and stop people from coming in and out because they want to have more paid. And they do these sitting strikes, and sometimes they also turn into violence. And so you have to be prepared for evacuation of management at local sites, could be factories, it could be office places. So that used to be a big thing in China for the local community to actually try to negotiate more payment to the local community. And then, of course, they are supported by the local politicians. That is also then trying to facilitate to get more payments to the community from a foreign entity. So you have a quite complex environment there from a loss prevention, risk management. So our job with PSU was to support and help clients on the Chinese market. And my focus was a lot on Scandinavian companies and some of the larger Scandinavian and also international retailers. So we did due diligence. We checked out the production offices, code of conduct, anti-corruption, some of the investigations with them also. And then we also did a lot of just on the ground surveillance with the local Chinese staff that really understood the complexity of the environment. And if you get leads, you have to go and check, because we had cases where you had a procurement of a product, and then you always get three different bids and you have three different owners. But once you do the due diligence, you actually see it's the same owner behind all the three companies rigging the bids. So no matter who you go to, he kind of pulls the strings behind it. So that's also something really to be careful about in China, the due diligence as who are you actually doing business with and who's the actual owner. And you might have factories, office places, you go there once week, it says Safe Asset Group, I come tomorrow, it says Retail Risk, and there's a new CEO, but it's the same place and same production. But so they do it just to show that they have the equipment and the office space, but it's not there, it's all fake.
Wow, just fascinating. Now I want to come on to what you're doing at the moment, but before we get into that, we're just going to take a very brief break and hear from our sponsors, and we'll be back in a moment.
Now, more than ever, retailers and shopping centres need to create efficient and safe shopping destinations that can thrive in the most challenging of market conditions. Sensormatic Solutions uniquely combines insights into loss and liability, shopper insights and inventory visibility to help you power operational excellence and deliver frictionless, secure, personalised shopper experiences while driving revenue. Visit us at sensormatic.com to learn more.
So welcome back to this week's edition of the Retail Risk Podcast, sponsored by Sensormatic. Just before the break, Eric was running through some of the quirks and nuances of doing business in China, really building on that Russian experience. Now, Eric, fast forward to today. Let me actually hand the floor, if you like, over to you. So all of that expertise, what are you doing at the moment?
Well, looking back, all of what I have done is setting standards. That's for Lindex when starting to expand into Central Europe, Eastern Europe. It was all about, you know, setting the standards to be able to roll out quickly and to quality assure safety and security, loss prevention and the routines in production offices. Same basically moving to Russia. It was about implementing the IKEA standards and improving them and just checking that the standards are there. And same kind of in China, that was looking at European clients trying to implement standards in China. Well, they have to understand, they have to adapt those standards to the local context. So really what we have done now and what we're doing as a Safe Asset Group is we are having a standard we call SHORE certification. And that is Safe Hospitality Office Retail and Environment. So we have set a standard for how to certify hospitality assets, retail assets, shopping centers is really what we have been focusing on. And we certify them as a safe environment. And that has taken us across the globe now, roughly to 27 countries. And one of the markets is South Africa, which today has had a quite a fair share of challenges to the retail environments and shopping centers with the looting that was ongoing. But what we do is we certify the operational excellence and set the standards for real estate where people eat, meet, drink, stay and work. So that's what we do. That's what we are providing.
And I think I'm right in saying, I'm not sure it was the first big success, but you certainly got very well known in the shopping centre, the shopping mall space. But was that the springboard to expand? Because that's where I know you from and know people
Correct.
That worked with you.
Yeah. No, we started really with shopping centres. And again, at my time at Lindex, we did a lot of negotiations with different property owners across Europe to really see how are their standards in the shopping center where we are placing our investment, where we are placing our store, our brand, our people, and drawing, you know, consumers into our store. We needed to know that they were working in a good way, being the responsible shopping center operator. So when we started out 5 years ago, then we focused on shopping centers and we went to some of the larger retailers and really made them understand that it should be a part of their policy to just ask if it's a certified safe asset, because then they don't have to do the due diligence. It's already been done. So we started out with Citycon with the roughly 40 shopping centers across the Nordics in five countries. And that was a good success for them and for us. And then we have expanded from that and focused really on shopping centers. And the last year we changed into Safe Asset Group instead from Safe Shopping Centers. And it was quite a natural evolvement, because a lot of the property owners, they have mixed use assets, hospitality assets, office and so on. So they asked us if we could certify office and hospitality assets as well. And so we had a well thought through process, product, competence within the property sector and real estate assets and retail. So that was really the natural evolvement and development. And the other development was I won't say bad language, but it was the situation here with COVID that hit everybody so hard. And that hit us quite hard as well, because most of our clients are out of Sweden. So we switched our certification process that we are really good at to digitalize it. And we came up with a COVID-19 certification. So up until today, we've done roughly 550 wow. certified assets. And a lot of those are shopping centers in Finland, in Sweden, in Poland, in Spain, in Russia, in South Africa, where we just look at the framework and we see that they are compliant to all the components. And then we certify them according to our standard. So that has been for us a great success and a good factor in developing trust with different property owners across Europe and the world now.
And a question. So if I was a retailer looking to take a unit within a shopping center, I would, if I saw that it had been approved, accredited by you, then there's a whole piece of work that I no longer need to do. On the other side, are you looking for the customers themselves to say, okay, you know, this has got the Safe logo on the doors on the way in, therefore I know it's going to be of a certain standard. Are you after both sides of the coin, as it were?
Well, initially, I would say that the retailer is the one that should ask exactly what you say, require from the shopping center owner, because then they know that all the fire hydrants are working, that the safety and security is on site, that good management policies, procedures, etc. The end consumer was not really in our target group, but when COVID really hit, that was the totally opposite. Then you wanted, as a tenant or as a landlord, to show the end consumer that somebody has verified that all the safety and hygiene cleaning procedures are in place. So that's really where we started to touch more with end consumer communication. So today that is part of the concept. So if you walk into some of the shopping centers in Scandinavia, in the Baltics, in Poland, you will see that they have in all of their doors and across their communication on websites that they are COVID compliant and COVID safe environment that has been checked and verified. And you do that to boost the confidence to tenants that they should know that the environment is safe, and to their consumers to boost the confidence in coming back and spending time and quality at this shopping center. So to improve and boost that confidence.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was going to ask you a moment. You say to boost confidence in coming back. And there's a lot of fascination at the moment about how quickly consumers are coming back to retail stores and shopping. Do you have any anecdotal or sort of evidence? Are your clients super busy and happy? Can you see differences in the markets? I'm just interested because you've got such an international exposure, if you like. What are you seeing?
Well, I would say it differentiates a lot in different markets, of course. And the driver there is basically the local legislation on the allowance of people into shopping centers. But what we have seen as a big change, which is also quite natural, that city centers across the world, and it doesn't matter regardless the legislation, due to people working at home, city centers have lost quite a big part of their business and footfall, and the drivers in restaurants and this spontaneous shopping rather than the local community center. So I have one client in Norway. They have actually produced even better result than before with all of their tenants and all of their shopping centers, despite the COVID-19. I have some city centers in Poland that has lost quite significantly in footfall and in sales. But we also see that the bounce back has been quite quick once legislation has been changed and the allowance of letting people back into offices and to retail space and to open up shopping centers. Then we've seen quite a good examples of bouncing back real quickly. You had a footfall of maybe 60% drop, and then all of a sudden in a week it's down to it's up to 90% of the normal. And also the figures, the financial figures, are there to back it up. So, and we've seen a huge spread depending on what type of center it is, meaning if it's a retail center, if it's a family center, or if it's a community center where you have more food and do it yourself. So it varies. I can't say I see a specific thing because we've seen so much and we try to draw this conclusion, but we see that building loyalty with your community really makes you a strong retail destination. And if you have that loyalty, your bounce back will be much faster from a financial and footfall perspective.
Yeah, I think you're spot on there, because if you think about the stores that have had huge queues outside when they reopened, it's where they've got that strong loyalty, isn't it?
And
there's the pent-up demand. So now, look, clearly, you know, looking forward, you know, Challenge is your middle name. What's on the horizon? And I've got visions of you risk managing the first retail store on Mars as part of Elon Musk's colonization program of the Red Planet.
That might be a good PR thing.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe so. So what's on the horizon next?
No, really, it's keep on developing our shore certification. And the other part we're adding on is quite due to the, again, situation with climate change. It's the environment. So we're also looking at environmental certification. And it's part of our shore certification today. But that's really what's next on our horizon. What can we do to further, again, show that clients are taking great initiatives to fight climate change. So that is next on our kind of horizon scanning here to see how we can support and help clients to certify that they are taking the reasonable and good steps to fight this extreme climate change. And it's nothing new, but now it's really with the reports being released around the world, wildfires, and just horrific environmental impact, to see that this is becoming one of our main focus to support clients to really show that they are doing a good job, being the responsible kind of operator, owner, investors, and taking the right steps.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'd like to think it's gone from being the right thing to do. Governments are now taking note, and I think consumers are making their choices as well on that basis. So to have some validation in your choices and to understand how that retailer's conducting itself, I think you're completely on the money and probably ahead of the game there. So wish you every success for that. Eric, it's always amazing to catch up. I find I could talk to you for hours on end with the...
it's always fun, Paul.
So thank you so much for being my guest this week. And I really look forward to actually being able to stand next to you in a bar. And if it's somewhere in Scandinavia, I hope you'll be buying.
I'll be buying, definitely, you know, and I'm really looking forward to it. Always a pleasure talking to you, and always getting inspired also with the retail risk environment. So thanks for having me on this talk.
Thanks, Eric.
Okay. Thank you very much.